Welcome, everyone, to episode number 7 of Potential Energy, otherwise known as POTE, where we delve into the problems with the current energy infrastructure and discuss potential solutions to those problems. We're going to save the world right here on this podcast. We talk about the issues from all angles: science, tech, law, money, social, you name it. We try and talk about it all. Today, we're going to be discussing coal. And I'm your host, Dr. Kirsten Sanford, also known as Dr. Kiki in certain circles. And I'm joined here in studio by regular contributor Keith Casto, who is an expert in environmental law, and Dr. Sally Benson, who is a scientist at Stanford University. And Sally, you're a new visitor to Potential Energy. Could you please tell us all a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here. This should be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. And I'm a hydrogeologist by training. I'm at Stanford University, a professor in the Energy Resources Engineering Department. And I'm also the executive director of something called the Global Climate and Energy Project. And our mission is to find new energy technologies that can be used to dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we work on everything from solar energy to fuel cells to carbon dioxide capture and storage to advanced batteries, you name it. We support fundamental research across the board.
I think the work you're doing is really interesting. So in addition to this program, I'm hoping that we'll get you on more often if you like it.
Well, thank you.
To learn more. And Keith, you have some things to say. Could you introduce yourself and make your disclaimer?
Certainly. It's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. I'm a partner at the law firm of Sedgwick, Dieter, Moran & Arnold. I specialize in environmental and energy law. And my statement really is a disclaimer that the information and opinions that I give today are entirely my own and do not represent the views of either the firm or our clients necessarily and should not be relied upon as legal advice.
I like that last part. Don't rely upon these statements legally. So I'm very excited to have both of you in here as Keith, you were talking earlier that you've actually had much experience dealing with the legal aspects of regulating and implementing coal-fired power plants. And Sally, you've also done a lot of work in this area. And so both of you are quite knowledgeable. So I'm really excited about the conversation we're going to have. What is coal? Why do some people love it? Why do other people hate it? Should we really get emotional about it? I think that we need to start the conversation with some of the scientific facts and the logic. Let's start with the very, very basics. Coal is an organic, solid fossil fuel, and you burn it, and it releases energy in the form of heat. But there are also many other things that are released in the process. Let's start off with the process. Coal, where does coal come from, and then what do we do with it, and how do we use it as energy?
Okay, I'll start with that. So basically, coal is organic matter. You know, picture a peat bog that was developed over many, many years, and you have this accumulation of organic matter that gets thicker and thicker over time. Eventually, it becomes buried, and it's compressed, and some of the water is pushed out, and the organic molecules change their state so that it basically becomes a fuel that has a very, very high energy density, which is why people like it. That's one of the big benefits, that, you know, if you have a cubic meter of coal, you can get a tremendous amount of energy out of that. So that's why it's had such an important role to play in the history of the evolution of mankind, because it was a good fuel. And it was also a fuel that was evident to humankind for a very long time, because unlike oil and gas deposits, which basically won't exist unless they're deeply buried and trapped underground, you can walk along the ground surface. You know, if you go to Colorado, you know, walk around and, you know, all of a sudden you see a coal deposit. So people also realize coal could be burned, because there are actually natural coal fires that are found around the globe, actually a surprising number of them, which actually in their own right contribute a lot of CO2 emissions. So it was evident to people this was a useful fuel. So that's what coal is. And today it's found sometimes right on the surface in very thick deposits, like in the area around Wyoming and Montana. And there are other places where it's deeply buried in thin little layers, and it has to be mined underground. And that's the other kind of mining you hear about that that has really caused such a safety problem for so many of the miners who've been involved in coal mining.
Something else I thought was interesting. I don't know if many people realize there are multiple types of coal. There are many different forms of coal, and they have to do with the amount of water that is held in the coal, how much energy, heat can come from the coal. Let me see if I can remember I don't remember all of the information, but there were like four or five different types of coal, and that's and where different types of coal are. Yeah, that determines what can be used, what's useful and what's not.
Yeah, so if you look at the origin of these different coals, you can imagine some settings where you have organic matter precipitating, and that's really all there are, you know, the remnants of trees and ferns and all of that. There are other places where at the same time a lot of sediments were being dumped in. If you picture, you know, it's a stream bed environment where you might have overflow of a stream into a marsh. You know, marshes are the kind of places. And you get a lot of other stuff that accumulates there. And so you can get, you know, things like sand and clay, but you can also go get trace elements, sulfur, selenium, mercury. And so there's a whole range of coals from, you know, very high-grade anthracite coals through, you know, lignite coals and things called brown coals. And then there's even peat, you know, which is basically sort of immature coal. And the quality of the energy you can get out of them depends vastly on, tremendously on the type of coal you have.
Keith, did you have anything that you wanted to say about the history or the basics of coal?
Well, I think one of the things to be considered about the form of coal is that there's a wide divergence in the efficiency when you combust it. I mean, coal content ranges in form from anthracite to lignite. It ranges in form from ash content. It varies widely as to sulfur content. And all those issues have tremendous ecological, environmental issues. And so you can have coal as a fuel and burn it fairly efficiently for certain kinds of pollutants such as sulfur dioxide and particulates, depending on the kind of coal you use. You may have to use more pollution control technologically to control those various things. And the ash content is essentially that portion of the coal that essentially is not combustible. It's really the waste part of coal. And the higher the ash content, it's fair to say the more technology you have to apply, and by extrapolation, the more energy you need to actually use that coal.
So how do we get the energy out of coal? We burn it, but what is the actual technological process? We have in the news you hear about old coal power plants and new coal power plants. What's the difference?
Oh, well, basically, we burn the coal, we heat up water, and we make steam, and then we have a steam generator that produces electricity. So that's basically the fundamental process that how we undertake that energy conversion.
And is there a difference in what we consider, though, an old coal power plant and the newer coal power plants? I mean, we're looking now at political issues of, we have all these old aging power plants. Do we add new technology to them, or do we shut them down and build new power plants? And are those new power plants really going to be up to snuff for the environmental regulations that people are starting to look at?
Right. So there's a whole spectrum. There's the really old coal plants, and those basically are steam boilers that don't run at very high temperatures. And those, the lower the temperature, the less efficient the intrinsic efficiency should be. So the really old coal plants are low temperature and not very efficient. There's now a whole new generation of sort of modern coal plants using supercritical water oxidation or supercritical temperatures or ultra-supercritical temperatures. Mm-hmm. Those get to be much more efficient, but it's still basically the same technology. there's a whole new category of technologies called gasification, sometimes called IGCC, that's integrated gasification combined cycle. And there it's a completely different idea. You actually partially oxidize the coal to make a gas. And the gas is a mixture of carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and hydrogen. And then you take that gas, the syngas essentially, and you then combust that and you run a power plant on gas. So it basically it's a way of converting something like coal, which is a solid fuel, to something like methane. It's not methane, but it's a gas, so it's much more akin to burning natural gas after you've gone through this gasification process. And that's the really modern coal plant that that people envision today when they talk about gasification.
Now, does that make I'm trying to imagine this. You use the coal once, you burn it to make create heat. Is this taking those byproducts to then create a natural gas that can then be used a second time for more energy, or is this a single use, still a single use process?
It's still fundamentally a single use process. You use it, you throw it away, you generate the wastes, and you know the waste products are somewhat different with gasification, but it's you've still got the same chemicals there, and either they end up going to the atmosphere or they end up going to solid waste.
Right. Do you have anything to add to this, Keith?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, essentially what we're talking about here is the second law of thermodynamics and basically waste energy, entropy, I guess, is the process we're really talking about. And no matter how you cut it, there's just a certain amount of coal that, at least at this point in time, technologically can't be used. So one of the aspects, besides air pollution and global warming and all that, is the fact that there's a lot of disposable solid waste material that has to be put somewhere. And that has created blight and a lot of other problems in certain areas of the country, including places like West Virginia. So it creates kind of a social cultural issue as in addition to an ecological issue.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Now, some of the ash is also used in cement manufacture, and it's done to sort of upgrade the quality of the cement. And so there are some uses for those waste products, but certainly they need to be considered.
Yeah. The ash maybe being used in concrete, or you mentioned earlier what was the compound that you...
Wallboard, gypsum, yeah. The sulfur, which is not the whole ash product, it's the sulfur part of it, can be made into wallboard, and some power plants do that today.
Are there any other... I'm thinking about, we've got all these waste products. People are certainly thinking about multiple uses for them or different ways that we can dispose of them. What are we doing with this, with the different components at this point?
Well, actually, apropos to global warming and climate change, is what do you do with the carbon dioxide? And there are new technologies today to divert that and store it. And whereas instead of emitting it into the atmosphere, you can put it potentially to other uses, in a stored capacity. So that is a relatively new phenomenon as far as that active consideration. And it's largely driven by concerns about climate change.
Yeah, it doesn't seem, though. I mean, there are very few of the carbon storage or very few facilities that are actually implementing carbon storage at this point in time. And I read something in my researching that the EU is not really putting a lot of money behind carbon storage and sequestration at this point in time. And the technologies and the knowledge to really allow this to happen are still kind of in development. And quite a far way off from really going into application and becoming useful. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I think it depends on when you say it's far off or not. There are three projects that do capture and store carbon in the world today. Together, they've been operating for about 20 years. So there are some projects. So, is it ready? If we had to do it today, I actually believe we could. Would it be as efficient and optimal and as reliable as we'd like? I think no. So I think that on the other hand, if you asked a company that's used to running a boiler today, you know, basically a steam generation plant, and you say, oh, well, whoops, tomorrow we want you to do something different, you know, they would say, wow, we don't have experience with this technology. And if you went to the bank and said, well, you know, I want to get financing for a project like this, they'd go, well, you know, how do we know it's reliable? Mm-hmm. So I don't think, you know, as a society, as an you know, industry is ready to do this. But in terms of, you know, do we know the basic physics and do we know the basic chemistry? Yeah, I think we know a lot. So it's just that there are a lot of people who need to get up to speed before we start doing this. The other thing, it costs a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody's just going to go out and do this voluntarily to increase the cost of electricity generation by, you know, 50% or maybe even 100%. Right. And no one will take the risk of putting, you know, carbon dioxide underground unless that there's some, you know, clear benefit like enhanced oil recovery. So until there's a serious climate policy, I don't think we're going to see people implementing this other than, you know, sort of with niche opportunities driven by producing more oil.
Right. And it seems like there are also still fears of, you know, well, if you put the carbon under the ground, does it stay there? Is it going to remain there? Is an earthquake going to allow it to suddenly escape? And, you know, will it, you know, like the lake in Africa, will it escape and suffocate hundreds or thousands of people? Will it cause a huge problem like that? Or, you know, is it going to stay in the soil? Is it going to turn into some kind of carbonate? Or, is it going to go through those chemical processes that will actually physically bind it to the soil itself? You know, I think we understand the physics, but I think there are still some questions as to how it'll exactly work.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I guess I think that there are plenty of places where we could do this today. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, oil reservoirs and natural gas reservoirs are known to trap fluids underground mm-hmm. for millions and millions of years. So, you know, so putting CO2 in those places will probably work really well. There's no reason. I mean, we know actually there are natural CO2 reservoirs too. Mm-hmm. So, I think that those are not so difficult to imagine doing, and I think the risk is very low. I think the bigger risks come when you say, oh, well, we have an aquifer, you know, that's filled with salt water. Well, now we want to put carbon dioxide. And how do you prove that you have a seal there? You know, how do you know that's, you know, going to be effective and that it's aerial, you know, extensive enough so mm-hmm. that the CO2 doesn't slip around the seal and come up? So I think those are the more challenging things as we move to saline aquifers, which are the biggest opportunity in terms of size and co-location with power plants. I think we've got a long way, a lot to learn, a lot of regulatory infrastructure to build, permitting these projects. So there's a long way to go there. But for oil and gas reservoirs, I think that we could do it today.
What do you think, Keith, with the regulatory side of things? Is there a big move currently to make this kind of sequestration and storage possible, or is there still a lot of resistance?
Well, there's a lot of regulatory controls that are at issue right now, but there's going to be more come implementation of climate change requirements because one of the concerns, and we haven't really talked about it, is what happens from a climate standpoint when there's a accidental release of a big bubble. And no one really quite knows exactly what would happen, what kind of, you know, acute climatological changes would occur. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the regulators are concerned about that in permitting these kinds of facilities. Any kind of a facility that has storage capacity has the potential for accidents, and you have to prepare for those accidents, and the regulations have to be put in place to protect against that kind of occurrence.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree regulations are going to be needed, but, you know, there is this question about the big bubble, you know, release scenario. And everyone thinks about Lake Nyos, which is a lake in Africa that had a catastrophic release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that was devastating mm-hmm. to a whole town, and thousands of people died and livestock, and it was absolutely devastating. And it was studied to figure out what caused that to happen. And it turns out that there are certain lakes in the world, they're called stratified lakes, that the water doesn't turn over, so the surface water doesn't mix with the deep water. And in those lakes, if you have a source of gas near the bottom, and this is a volcanically active area, if the gas accumulates, you can end up with a lot of gas in that water. You know, just like your, you know, Perrier water, you can have like 5% gas in the water. And what happened is that some event at Lake Nyos triggered the turnover. And it could have been an underwater landslide, could have been a seismic event that wasn't detected. So the water column started to turn over. And once that turnover happens, you end up with a very quick release, in this case of a tremendously large amount of carbon dioxide. So, but basically it was released from the water column. It wasn't released from the geologic formations under the lake. So, you know, one of the questions is, well, could you imagine that scenario for geologic storage? And for geologic storage, the carbon dioxide is deep under many, many layers of rock. And so, you know, unless you somehow had a lake near a storage site where you were accumulating the CO2, and unless the lake, you know, didn't turn over, it was one of these stratified lakes, it's very hard to imagine a Lake Nyos kind of scenario for CO2 storage. That's not to say that leaks can't happen. I mean, we know that faults and fractures could release CO2. We know there could be well blowouts, and those would release CO2, and none of those would be desirable and all have, you know, potential impacts of, you know, great concern. But they're not the sort of catastrophic release scenario. And in fact, a number of scientists have been trying to study, could you create scenarios where you could have a catastrophic release by, you know, having gradual leaks that build up in the groundwater and then something, it just gets to be too much. And those scientists have concluded that as long as the CO2 is not hot, so it's basically, you know, some normal geothermal gradients, that though they can't generate them with their modeling tools. So I don't want to underestimate that, you know, the subsurface is complex, but at least to the extent that scientists have studied it, they don't have good evidence to suggest that such a release would happen.
Yeah. I guess on the other side of that, you mentioned that there are small leaks that are probably going to happen. You know, there's no perfect seal, I guess, for an underground situation. And if you're thinking about storing carbon dioxide and to keep it out of the atmosphere, leaks are suboptimal.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, no one would design a project with a leak. And I don't think we will ever permit projects where we anticipate leakage. I mean, there are some people who suggest that. I personally think it's a bad idea, because it's very hard to assign a particular environmental impact to a certain size leak, because a very little leak could accumulate in a valley be harmful, or, you know, you could have a really big leak that wouldn't harm anybody but still wouldn't be good. So so I think, you know, the design goal has to be zero leaks, and the question is can we get sufficiently proficient to characterize a site so that we could provide a reasonably high degree of assurance that would be so? But certainly, you know, and I've done studies to show that if you have a leak rate of greater than, say, you know, 0.01% per year, that if done on a very large scale, that, you know, you could have so many releases that you'd decide, oh, this wasn't even a very effective approach at all. Right. So the leakage needs to be extremely small to have this become effective at all.
Right. I mean, because you want to consider the cost effectiveness, and you also want to consider the actual effectiveness of the storage itself, with the end goal of keeping this compound carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Because if you're just going to end up releasing it over time anyway, what's the use?
Yeah, why spend all that money? I mean, you'd be spending a lot of money for a very short-term gain. So that wouldn't make sense.
Now, it seems to me that with, you know, you know, there are only, like you said, three projects currently that are doing this successfully. Are they doing it successfully? I guess that is the question. Is it successful?
There's the Norwegian project, and that one is monitored very extensively by a worldwide team of scientists, and they've not found any evidence of leakage. You know, they've it's very reliable in terms of the injection. So that one is going extremely well. The there's a project in Canada, the Weyburn Project, and that's going extremely well. Again, international team of scientists, independent of the companies who are the operators. And then the final project is in Algeria. And there's a little bit less known about that project because they're just beginning to get their monitoring program up and running. But again, they've got European scientists. There are a number of teams from the U.S. also working there. And again, no evidence for problems. But there's a little less known about that site just because it's very difficult to work in Algeria. It's hot.
Right. Yes, I'm sure it's probably not the first location that a scientist would love to go. But
yeah, difficult working conditions.
So aside from carbon storage, in terms of there are other emissions. There's carbon dioxide, which we want to deal with, but there's also the nitrous oxides or nitrogen oxides, the sulfur oxides, and probably a number of other particulates and gaseous components to the emissions from these power plants that are currently in operation. To be able to really reduce carbon dioxide and the emissions of these other components. Are the technologies currently available to us to do this, to do it successfully? Is it cost effective? And are regulations working to get power plants to implement the technologies that we have? Keith.
Yes, I would say that we have technologies that have been around for a long time to control conventional criteria pollutants under the Clean Air Act. The technologies that have been used to control sulfur dioxide, for example, have been largely falling into two categories. One is either scrubbing or really controlling the fuel through the sulfur content. And the low sulfur fuel has largely come from the eastern part of the United States, and that largely comes from West Virginia. And that's a very high quality control, and many, many power companies have relied very extensively on those kinds of coals. I think the statistics show that there's less of that coal than there used to be because it's being consumed. And the Powder River Basin out in the western part of the United States, which is just huge, tends to have not the same quality coal. Doesn't have the has much higher sulfur content. And that necessarily constrains your options. You have to go to other ways to control the sulfur dioxide. The other problem about a lot of the higher sulfur coal, they tend to be high ash as well and tend to generate more particulates. So you've got a double whammy. You've got to deal with two kinds of pollutants that require a technological fix as opposed to a fuel control fix. And that, you know, is a big concern, separate and apart from the carbon dioxide global warming issues.
Yeah, and, you know, there's mercury as well.
Right.
And, you know, there are current, you know, moves to increase mercury controls. But I think it's a bigger problem than the United States. If we're just looking at the United States, that's way too small a view. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, you know, with all the coal burning in China. That we now have a lot of mercury that travels across the Pacific and is deposited in North America. So when we talk about effectiveness of controls, it's partially what we can do in America, but it's also how can we create worldwide cooperation with you know, China and India, Australia, you know, the really big coal burners who all have, you know, we might have some of the cleaner coal in this world than compared to a lot of the coal in Australia and China and India as well. So it's a big issue that we need to work on.
Yeah, it seems as though it would benefit everybody to have technology transfer from United States and other first world nations that are using cleaner coal technologies to these nations that are coming up in their industrial phase. So China is growing, their industry's growing, they're burning more and more coal. I read something they're going to, by 2030 or something, they're going to increase by I think they're going to increase by like 500 gigawatts worth of coal-based power. like it's a huge
It's staggering. It's really staggering.
Absolutely staggering. And if there's, you know, if they're not keeping up, all that, you know, all of the particulates, all of the gas, everything is going to be going up into the atmosphere, onto the ground, and going to end up, you know, here, there, everywhere.
The statistics are that China is developing 1 500-megawatt power plant per week. I mean, it's quite quite astounding, really. And that naturally means that the coal's got to come from somewhere. And that brings into play a lot of economic issues. Basically, you're talking about exports from the United States to China. Mm-hmm. When we have a negative trade balance, there's a lot of market demands to supply coal to China.
Yeah, Australia is now starting to export coal as well. So a whole other dimension.
Right. Australia has fairly large coal reserves.
Yes, they do.
Don't they? Yeah. And the United States, with our large coal reserves, they are there is one piece of news from, let's see, where is it, from Red Orbit from the end of August that says that coal production in Virginia is down nearly 18% in the last year. So coal production in the United States has been falling, or at least of that high quality coal that we were discussing earlier. That's been falling steadily. It's not low by any means, but at the same time, we also have an increase in the price of coal. So it's up to something like $140 a ton.
Yeah, but if you look at Powder River Basin coal, then they're going great guns. I think if you actually look at overall coal production in the United States, I think it's grown slightly. Mm-hmm. So, and it's just this, I think, scarcity and high cost of those higher quality coals. But back to the technology transfer issue, I think that's extremely important. And there are government efforts and, you know, some of the multinational corporations who work in all places, you know, are certainly prepared to for anyone who's willing to pay, you know, introduce the best technologies. But this whole willingness to pay, I think, is a really big issue, because if you you know, if it's going to cost you 20% more, 30% more to put in something with extreme controls, and it's going to cost you more to operate, and if it's that, or, oh, by the way, we could just build a whole another one, you know, and you know, provide all these, you know, electricity services to people who don't have them today. I think that tension between just sort of going out and doing the cheapest, lowest cost thing, difficult to control. And so there, I think there needs to be a worldwide ethic that says, as we use whatever resources we use to produce energy, that we've got to make sure the best available controls are required by everyone.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a hard balance, because there's definitely going to be one side of the equation where there are going to be people saying, well, we're a developing country. It's everybody's right to have electricity. We want to give electricity to people at a very low cost. And so why don't we just put it in? We have our own coal, or we can buy coal from, you know, the lowest. We can buy coal from whoever will sell it to us. And then if there isn't that control from the other side, that's what's going to happen. There needs to be a balance. People saying, well, it matters. Let's think about the future. Let's think about, you know, not here and now in our energy consumption now, but later down the road, what's going to happen.
I think what you're talking about is cost externalities, and that is there are costs that are imposed on society, and whether those costs should be internalized by the producer and the user, essentially. And a cost externality is nothing more than the cost that society has to pay in the form of dealing with pollution in some form. Whether it's carbon dioxide or criteria, conventional air pollutants, the question, who bears the cost of controlling it so you don't impose it upon society? And the Clean Air Act is certainly based on the premise that those cost externalities should be borne by the one that generates the pollution. Yeah. Is that a worldwide ethic? Maybe not yet.
Right. But if you look at things like carbon dioxide and rightly so, developing countries will argue that, well, if you look at the burden associated with, you know, historical carbon dioxide emissions, you know, the developed world, you know, the United States, Europe, have really contributed the vast majority of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So, well, even though we might, you know, China's generating, you know, as much now as the United States has, if you look at the damages damages associated with historical burning, well, you know, the burden does fall on the developed world. So in terms of equity, I think that that's an important issue, is that, that, you know, the developed world has benefited by this.
Yeah. Do you think that there is such a thing as clean coal? Like, is it really possible? It's the catchphrase that everyone is bandying about. Is it real?
I think the answer is yes, but it comes at a cost. To achieve clean coal, you have to do something with coal as it naturally exists. And that process of converting coal in its natural form to clean coal requires the application of technology, and the application of technology, in fact, uses more energy, and the use of energy requires the
more energy.
actually generates the potential for carbon dioxide and other pollutants. So the concept that has been employed for a long, long time, since the 1970s, is net energy, and that is what is the net amount of energy that you derived after you deduct the cost of generating that energy? And so when you talk about clean coal, you have to think of it in either gross terms or net terms, as far as to what is the essentially net benefit that you get from that clean coal. And depending on your point of view, you come up with a different analysis as to whether it's truly clean.
Yeah. You know, I guess I think there's cleaner coal. You know, I don't know about clean coal. I mean, you know, the production, you know, the mining of coal, the transportation of coal from the point of mining to where it's used, all of the issues about water use, and you know, I think that clearly there are environmental impacts associated with any amount of coal, you know, in the mining and you know, to the extent that can we restore, you know, habitats that were damaged during the mining process. So to me, it's cleaner coal. And certainly it's a, you know, a vast improvement if we include controls for carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide and all these things. It's cleaner coal. And and so that, you know, I think that is sufficient reason to consider all these additional controls, but to call it, you know, clean, it's clean compared to what, you know?
I think one of the things that has to be considered is the transportation of coal. Traditionally in this country, electric power plants have tended to be produced and built and constructed in areas where they actually drive their coal. In other words, they're called mine mouth plants. And so you've got a number of plants in the TVA system, Paradise and others, that are actually built right next door to a major source of coal. Mm-hmm. What we're doing now is quite different. We're taking coal from the ground in the United States and transporting it across the ocean to China. Mm. And that cost of transportation of a very heavy solid creates its own form of societal and climatological issues. Takes energy to transport it across the sea. It generates other ecological problems that are much different than when you only have to transport it next door.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that all energy, all human use of energy, all, you know, human with, you know, interaction with the environment has associated environmental impacts. So, you know, I think what we need to do is think about, well, you know, coal compared to hydroelectric, compared to oil and gas, you know, all of these things have impacts. So I think we need to make all of them as clean as they can be. But I don't think that there's any perfect energy generation technology, which is why I think that energy efficiency is incredibly important in terms of making buildings more efficient, improving the efficiency of transportation, building more public transportation, because the less energy we can use, the less the overall impacts will be, regardless of what kind of energy we're using.
I think the analysis that has been used since the 1970s and has become really quite in vogue today is life cycle analysis. The life cycle of any particular technology, whether it's a renewable source or whether it's a more traditional source like coal, goes through basically the beginning to the end. And
Cradle to grave.
And coal is certainly one of those that has many, many steps. And so when you take the cumulative impact of all those steps, you may come up with a different analysis as to how it compares to other forms of energy.
Now, when we're looking at coal, it's about $1 to $2 per million BTUs. I mean, it's cheap compared to many other forms of energy, renewable or non-renewable. And so that makes it something that's very, very attractive to many people who are producing energy and using energy. And it's also something that has made coal a huge sticking point, especially here in the United States, where it is a major resource. And we're starting to question, is coal something that we want to continue to use as petroleum is something that becomes more and more expensive? Is natural gas on its own? How do we divide, you know, our use of these energy sources?
Yeah, your point that coal is cheap is really interesting. I was looking at some data on the cost per joule of energy, comparing coal, natural gas, and oil over a long time period. And it turns out for a long time, the costs were actually very equivalent of oil, gas, and coal in terms of cost per unit of energy. But over the last several years, oil has just skyrocketed. It is an incredibly expensive energy source, and natural gas, too. So coal, you are absolutely right. Coal is sitting there at the bottom of the list in terms of cost. So I agree with you. It's going to be extremely tempting to use it. And we've been talking about coal for electricity production, but there's also a lot of interest in coal for making liquid fuels.
Right,
and so the whole coal to liquids issue, and we really need to consider the environmental impacts associated with that, because just on a simple basis, if we produced a liquid fuel from coal and we looked at the life cycle CO2 emissions compared to electricity or a gasoline car, they're about double. So we have got to be really careful, and as we develop policies that if we incentivize more use of cheap coal without environmental controls, we're going to have skyrocketing CO2 emissions.
Yeah, I think historically an interesting anecdote is that the coal to liquid process is not new. It was used by Germany during World War II because their sources of oil got constrained because of the war, and they were highly innovative and highly energetic about developing new technologies rather rapidly, and they developed the whole concept of synfuels.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, we really had about 60 years of extensive background in synfuels. Synfuels now is at least come back in vogue as a major option that we ought to consider.
Yeah.
But once again, we get into this life cycle analysis. What does it take to generate synfuel? And what is the net benefit as opposed to that? And then we talked earlier about the price, the cost of coal. And it has been argued that coal has been the price does not really reflect the actual societal cost, the cost externalities. Does the cost of coal actually reflect the imposition on society of the full impact of that particular technology? It really creates a different kind of comparison when you bring into all those issues. So you've got not only the net energy deduction, but you've also got really the sort of price equilibrium.
Yeah, I think the syn fuel issue is rather interesting, especially like you said, it's coming back into vogue. There's a company called the Gas Technology Institute, Synthesis Energy Systems. Also, they're developing these gasification processes for the what they're calling the lower energy forms of coal. So they're taking like the bituminous coal and turning that into a liquid form of fuel. You know, is it, I mean, you definitely don't want to be taking the high quality coal and putting it through this this liquefaction process. But does it, when you start looking at the different forms of fuel of coal and what we are getting from the ground and what we're using for different types of energy production, do you start getting a cost benefit analysis? You know, how does it start working out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it might be cost effective if you don't include the fact that you have these externalities that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. If you have a high quality coal and you want to gasify it, that's actually quite efficient. If you take a low quality coal, you know, often you have to basically boil a bunch of water to drive the water off. You have mm-hmm. to heat up all of these solids that don't go to energy production. So the overall energetics of converting a low-quality coal to a liquid or a synfuel is even worse. And the environmental consequences will be larger as well.
That's interesting. So even though they're saying we're taking care of the waste coal and we're getting rid of this waste coal and we're doing something with it, it's still not as efficient of a process and as good of a process, as clean of a process as it would be if they were using the higher quality.
Right. Yeah, you know, and
it's fascinating.
If somebody wanted to include, you know, CO2 controls and, you know, separate the CO2 and either find some use for it or store it, you know, then I think you can start looking at it on a comparable basis. But the cost of that is going to change the overall economics. So I think we don't want to fall into the trap of looking at the economics of processes without considering the full range of environmental controls.
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea. So we've covered a lot of different topics so far, from the basics of coal to some of the clean technologies, some of the storage and sequestration. The year that I see thrown around is 2030, people want, or that we're going to need, somewhere on the level of over 200 coal fire plants, 500 megawatt coal fired plants, by the year 2030. But at the same time, Keith, I'm sure you're quite familiar with this. There's a lot of resistance to the development of new coal power plants. New plants are being proposed, yet at the same time, people are coming in and saying, you know, not in my backyard, or, you know, take a look at the environmental regulations, and you're not, that this new plant is not going to resolve any issues. Are we going to really be able to meet our power needs? If we were to try and say, yes, coal, we're going to use it. Are we going to be able to meet our power needs? Are enough plants going to be built?
I think one of the startling statistics is that several hundred major projects have been canceled in the last, I think it's just last year.
Yeah.
You know, I would say that were on the drawing boards, that were being planned at various phases. And I think it reflects sort of a growing concern about what you just talked about. The not in my backyard is certainly one of them. But I also think from a sort of a general policy standpoint, there's a fundamental debate going on about the future of coal. And I think part of that concern is that by focusing on the development of coal, are we also neglecting looking at alternatives to coal? In other words, where you focus your energies, your research and development dollars, are you essentially choosing a technology, you know, and if you throw a lot of money at one form of energy, are you basically abandoning another? And I think what's going on at many different levels is money is being diverted from research in this area to research in other areas. And coal is sort of losing favor.
Yeah, I want to go back to, you know, the coal plants. So imagine you're a bank, you're some investor, and you're looking at a project, a coal-fired power plant project, and you do not know what the price will be per ton of CO2 that you emit to the atmosphere. Tremendous uncertainty. It could be $5 per ton, $10, it could be $30, it could be $50. Mm-hmm. And so if you're trying to sort of, you know, pencil out the numbers on whether this is a good investment or not, and you have this huge uncertainty, which really is equivalent to about 50% of the cost of the project, that is just a tremendous financial risk.
Yeah.
So I think that until, you know, it's clear where we're heading with regard to CO2 controls policy, it will be difficult to make those investments. I think regarding, you know, the cleaner coal plants, which include sequestration, I think we need a number of demonstration projects to test out the technology. You know, can we effectively site CO2 storage projects? Can the reliability of an IGCC, you know, gasification plant, be sufficiently high? And can we get enough trained people to operate those? And I think if the answer is to those is yes, you know, then I think that coal may play a role. And maybe in this country, I think if you look at places like Australia and China and India, you know, there's no intention of not building an economy based on those natural resources. So we need to look beyond our own sort of narrow view. Maybe we're lucky. Maybe we have options. Maybe we have enough. Well, we have a huge solar resource in the Midwest. We have, yeah. I mean, not in the Midwest, in the Southwest. We have a very large wind resource right through the middle of the country. So maybe we're lucky enough, but we need to look to the other countries as well and participate in the development of a technology that I think will really be crucial to deal with these worldwide emissions. I want to say a little bit more about this idea, though. If we do demonstrations in CC, you know, carbon dioxide capture and storage, are we diverting attention to away from, you know, solar energy and wind energy? And certainly what we're seeing today is this tremendous explosion of investment in wind, you know, which is fantastic. And there's a lot of private capital going into improvement of wind power, making bigger blades. I mean, that's a hot industry.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel quite confident wind is very robust. If we look at solar energy, if we look at the amount of federal funds and venture capital funds going into solar devices, it dwarfs the investment in carbon dioxide capture and storage technologies, even with the proposed demonstration projects. So, you know, if we look at the investment today in fusion, if we look at the investment in fission, they are not smaller and being diminished by the investments in sequestration. I personally believe that we need a much bigger investment in all of those technologies because we, in essence, need to transform our entire energy system. We have, you know, maybe 40 years, maybe 50 years to basically go from one that we rely on emission, you know, technologies that emit CO2 to ones with, you know, no CO2, you know, very little, right. Very low values. And how are we going to accomplish this without a massive investment across the board in all kinds of technologies? And I hope there are ones we don't even know about yet.
I think it should be emphasized that one of the reasons why a lot of these projects were canceled is for lack of financing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the major lenders, and I'm not even talking about venture capitalists that are basically funding emerging technologies. I'm talking about the conventional lenders don't want to put money into coal-fired or coal-based technologies because of the anticipated cap-and-trade system. The cap-and-trade system contemplates that there's an equation. There's the sellers and the buyers. And I think there's a perception that if you're in a coal-based technology, you're going to be forced to buy emissions credits from those people that are on the sort of low end of the carbon dioxide-generating equation, and it's going to increase the cost of coal-based technology indirectly to the point where it may become a bad investment. One only has to look to really the major investors to see what's happening. You know, it's follow the money.
Right. Now, in terms of research, is there a lot of research going into? Is it a growing research field? These clean coal technologies? Is it something that's building and growing, or is it kind of stabilized?
Yeah. Well, if you look back 10 years ago, there was nothing. You know, I mean, this was an area that nobody was interested in. As a matter of fact, it was so new, nobody even heard about it and thought it sounded like a really crackpot scheme, to be honest.
You want to do what?
That's right. Yeah. What are you talking about? But in the last 10 years, there's been a really worldwide growth in investment in this area. Probably started really in Europe and then in the United States, and now even places like China are investing in both in the capture side and the gasification side, and as well as storage. So, you know, it's certainly growing. It's not a tremendously large program in the United States compared to a lot of other, you know, investments that are made.
Right.
But it is growing. And universities across the country and really across the world are starting to hire faculty members who are interested in working in these areas.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier the idea of if we start building plants that involve the capture, storage, or even gasification, you need people to run them who are qualified and understand the system. Yeah, is the training that's going on, is it substantial enough to be able to cover that at this point?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, there's research. I mean, that operating a big gasification, you know, basically a huge chemical plant.
Yeah.
I mean, that fundamental shift from running, you know, basically boilers and generators to running very large chemical plants. Well, if you look, who has the experience doing that? Well, refining, oil refineries, they do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They produce hydrogen to upgrade the crude oil. So they know how to do that. But do they have a huge excess labor force? I kind of doubt it, given how that, you know, that industry is going.
Yeah.
And if you look at other chemical industries, you know, I don't think there's a surplus, so there's going to be a need. And I think that's why the utilities are particularly concerned when they, you know, sort of see potential, you know, looming regulation requiring these kind of things. It's like, well, how are we going to do this?
Yeah. How are you going to have the people who can then follow the regulations and understand how everything's going to work, and also foresee future regulations and future hurdles to go through?
Yeah.
It's definitely fascinating. I'm absolutely fascinated with this entire area because it is so controversial at the moment. Yet at the same time, it's providing a basic need. It's giving us energy, and it's doing a lot of energy production at this point.
50% of our electricity, you know, it's huge. You know, what would we do without, if you said, oh, we have to shut down the coal plants today, we would be in big trouble. You know, it's all you had to do is remember the power failure two nights ago, and it's like, I wanted my electricity.
Yeah, and I saw from a paper that you recently wrote, let's see if I can, on sustainability, it was in the materials research bulletin. Is that, yes, the MRS bulletin, April 2008, and an article on sustainability and energy conversions that you wrote with Franklin Orr. There's a graph that shows that combustible renewables and waste actually decreased from 11% to 10%, whereas coal has increased, natural gas has increased, oil actually decreased a little bit. So energy consumption from these renewables that we're supposedly putting all sorts of time and effort into right now and money, that's decreased since 1973.
Yeah, and the difficulty is they're starting from such a small base. You know, if you look at the percent that's provided by, you know, what we think of, you know, solar, wind, it's really a tiny fraction. So even if they're growing at a very rapid pace, which they are, even a small rate of growth in sort of our core energy technologies, the fossil fuel-based technologies, kind of swamp this growth. So
Right. There
is a need to, you know, incentivize and encourage the growth of the renewables, because our demand for energy is growing faster overall than the actual amount of delivered renewable energy.
Did you have a comment, Keith?
I think one of the fundamental policy decisions that has to be made is where you're going to put the research dollars from a government standpoint. Certainly the private sector has a major role in this, but I think the government, the Department of Energy, has a role in promoting certain technologies. And I think within the Department of Energy, There are big debates, you know, where you're going to shift the government support. And I think right now, I think there's a feeling that you don't want to put your eggs in any one basket, that there should be a certain amount of parity between the various choices. But in the private sector, that parity doesn't seem to be there. It seems to me that at least in the VC community, renewables have a much more attractive investor base than say coal. Mm-hmm. And I think that's reflected that in the statistic that the number three area of growth in venture capital is in clean tech and renewable resources. Very little of any of that money is going into coal.
Right.
And I think you can understand why. I mean, if we could, you know, increase the efficiency of a solar photovoltaic device from today's level to, you know, 30-40%, and if you could replace, you know, very expensive silicon-based cells with cells that you basically make on a printer with earth-abundant materials, you know, if you could realize those dreams, the solar resource is huge. Yeah. It's absolutely tremendous resource. So you can see why people get so excited. You know, there's a prize out there, and it's the same community who, you know, made the computer revolution and the IT revolution, all those things that, you know, have improved the quality of life for everyone. So that same kind of technology could play out in the energy field. So I think that is why people are so excited.
I think another societal issue that sort of affects the choices here is that renewables can be decentralized down to the consumer level. I mean, it's quite possible, and of course we have a history, that wind power was used by individual farmers over the years. Solar can be employed on a residence, but it's very difficult to decentralize coal.
Right. It's hard to put a coal power plant in your backyard.
But I think we need to also realize that, you know, at the end of the day, people are going to want power, you know, 24 hours a day. They're going to want power during the winter. They're going to want power during the summer. They want power during a stormy time. And so to the extent that we need to build a network that provides these reliable energy services, you know, I think that the people are going to need to rely on some common energy supplies and services. So even if we go to a very large amount of renewables, you know, one cold, dark week in the middle of the winter, and, you know, we're going to be begging for electricity from somebody else. So I think there are limits to which this decentralization will be cost effective or desirable.
Right. There's going to have to be centralized production at some point for everyone. Now, in terms of where we stand with subsidies, there are currently many subsidies for alternative fuels, but I'm not aware of what's going on subsidy-wise. Is there more subsidy for fossil fuel at this point in time?
What I'm familiar with is some incentives to build some large-scale IGCC plants to get this technology out there, to get it going. That beyond that, I'm not aware. I mean, certainly, you know, government-funded R&D is also helpful, and certainly there is that in the area of carbon dioxide capture and storage. But specific subsidies for plants with capture, I'm not aware of those.
Yeah. Do you have any knowledge of where the subsidies stand at this point, Keith?
I think that's my understanding as well. I think, frankly, there's been sort of a reticence, especially since the administration is kind of winding down to the end of this term, I think to make a big commitment to, for example, coal gasification requires a pretty big chunk of money. And I think people are reluctant to make big commitments in this sort of politically transitional time.
All right. Well, we are just about at the end of our hour. I just wanted to get final thoughts from both of you on, you know, where we stand with coal currently, and where you see the future of coal. Where are you putting your money? We'll start with Keith.
I think we've gone through this in this series, an exploration of many different technologies. And I think one of the abiding principles that seems to emerge from this whole series is that we don't want to put all of our eggs in one basket. We've got to think in terms of and consider every technology on its merits. There's a certain amount of what I would call confrontation and essentially disagreement ideologically about whether you should go one way or the other. I think that's a bit of a mistake. I think we've got to give careful consideration to all these technologies and look at them, each one on its merits, and compare them. But I think more fundamentally is that I think the future of the world is dependent upon a mix and not just selecting a few technologies, because I think it's true. You take something like coal, it may be an excellent resource for base power plants, base load power plants. Solar may be great in the Southwest, but it may not be that great in Maine. So, you know, we've got to look at different local issues to make our choices about energy.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with everything that you say. You know, we need to keep all options open. And again, hopefully we have more options going into the future. I think with regard to coal, you know, there's sort of two issues. One is the future, you know, new coal plants. But there's also the existing stock of coal-fired power plants that exist today. So certainly trying to develop retrofit options for those so that that they don't, you know, continue to emit into the future is going to be important. And along those lines, you know, again, looking at China and India, you know, they're building modern power plant, coal-fired power plants today. You know, I'm sure that those are going to be running 30 years from now. I'd be much happier if we developed a retrofit technology to capture and store the technology for all those plants. So we need to keep a worldview and think about, you know, the existing stock and preventing future emissions from that as well as new builds.
Yeah, I think it's been enlightening to discuss this topic with both of you, and I definitely feel the more that I look at coal, the more I realize that, you know, we're not going to get rid of it anytime soon, and to think that we can just say, oh, coal's dirty, let's just not use it. It emits carbon dioxide. That's a pipe dream, and that's not going to happen. We're going to rely on coal for quite a bit longer for a lot of our power. But I think everyone here is in full agreement that it's going to become just a part of the total energy profile as we move into the future, and maybe less dominant in the profile than it is currently. I thank both of you for joining me today and coming to Pixelcore to record this episode of Potential Energy. It's been great to talk with you. I've loved speaking with you. So thank you very much, Sally and Keith.
Thank you, Kirsten.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome, and I hope that we can get both of you back on again at some time. Next episode, we will be discussing ethanol, that lovely biofuel. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, email me, Kirsten, at thisweekinscience.com, and tell your friends to look for Potential Energy in iTunes. We're out there.